Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany. My name is Abubakar Jalo.
And my name is Ipora Nyambura. If you're listening to us via Facebook, DW Africa, don't hesitate to share this audio and leave us your comments.
Now coming up... Ghanaians take to the streets to protest a new deal that will give unprecedented access to U.S. troops in their country.
Yes, we are citizens. We can't just be there and allow another sell us out as very cheap. No way. We won't allow it.
Our country is more than $20 million. You are bringing in people that whatever they come to do here, we can't do them anything. If they come to rip our wives, our sisters, our mothers, we have nothing to say.
And who is the new Prime Minister of Ethiopia?
He's very young, at 41. He's very eloquent. That's a change from your sort of trademark Ethiopian politician. And he has a huge appeal with the young population. As you know, Ethiopia is a very young country.
We will be hearing more from Lutka Shadomski, head of DW's Amharic service, shortly.
And we have more stories lined up for you right after this roundup of world news.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Chinese President Xi Jinping has held a secret meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Beijing, with the Chinese state media confirming that the surprise meeting took place from Sunday until Wednesday. During the visit, Kim reportedly told Xi that his regime would be committed to denuclearization if the U.S. and South Korea respond to their efforts in goodwill. South Korean government spokesperson Park Tae-hyun says improved relations could help reduce tensions on the peninsula.
I think improvement in the North Korea-China relationship ahead of the Inter-Korean Summit and U.S.-North Korea Summit will be helpful in solving the problem on the Korean Peninsula, such as denuclearization and establishment of peace.
Kim's first known trip abroad since assuming power in 2011 comes ahead of scheduled talks with South Korean President Moon Jae-in and U.S. President Donald Trump. Turkey reportedly arrested a German man on terror charges on Wednesday, alleging that 28-year-old Patrick Kraker tried to cross into Syria to join Kurdish militants. Turkey's state media reported that the man was arrested in southeastern Turkey after they found media on his person related to the Democratic Union Party and the Kurdistan Workers Party. Both groups are considered terrorist organizations by Turkey. German government spokesperson Stefan Seibert has defended Berlin's decision to expel four Russian diplomats over the poison attack on a former Russian double agent in Britain. Speaking in Berlin, Seibert said measures by the German government were necessary.
For us, and this is probably true for other European partners, this decision is legitimate and justified by detailed presentation of the British side and the intensive debates held at the European Council.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Ethiopia's ruling People's Revolutionary Democratic Front Party has selected Abiy Ahmed as its leader. He takes over after Haile Mariam Desalegn resigned last month. Abiy will be the first person from the Oromo ethnic group to lead the party in its 27-year history. He's expected to be sworn in as prime minister within days. Ugandan authorities have closed 23 radio stations for allegedly promoting witchcraft and for trying to con people out of money. A Ugandan communications spokeswoman said the stations had interviewed healers who claimed they could cure AIDS and cancer. The station's licenses have been suspended until further notice. And now in sports, Germany's national football team lost to Brazil 1-0 in Berlin on Tuesday evening in a friendly game. Gabriel Jesus scored the single goal in the first half. It was a two sides' first meeting since Germany beat Brazil 7-1 in the 2014 World Cup semifinals, and it's also the first German national team loss since the Euro 2016 semifinals. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You are listening to DW's Africa Link program. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are live on Facebook, DW Africa. Share and drop your comments there on the stories that we are covering. Now, hundreds of Ghanaians clad in red attire marched through the streets of Ghana's capital, Accra, to say no to an agreement between Accra and the United States. The deal allows the U.S. to set up a military base in Ghana.
And Washington would also be allowed to bring in its facilities without paying tax and use Ghana's radio spectrum for free. In return, Ghana will get a $20 million American investment in the country. Isaac Kaletsi joined the demonstrators and filed his report.
The protesters held placards with inscriptions such as "Put Ghana First," "Ghana is not for sale," "Ghana against military base," "Create jobs, not military base," among others. The protesters say they also disagree with the aspect that allows U.S. troops to carry firearms in the country. Ghana's parliament approved the agreement last week. Johnson Asiru Nketiah, an opposition National Democratic Congress Party politician and one of the leaders of the demonstration, explains why the deal is bad for Ghana.
We are not the only country that enters agreement with foreign powers. If you check the agreement that Kenya, for instance, entered into with UK, there are clauses that retain the sovereignty of Kenya. Come to Ghana. You look at this agreement, I see that everything about our sovereignty will be gone. And this is not going to be the last one.
Opposition MPs had boycotted the parliamentary enactment of the deal, demanding further consultation. The demonstration, according to those leading it, is to force President Nana Akufo-Addo to reverse the deal or renegotiate it. The president has not responded to the demands of the opposition, which the demonstrators described as worrying.
I've just realized that our country has been placed on a very silver platter. Yes, we are citizens. We can't just be there and allow another sell us out as very cheap. No way. We won't allow it. How much will even the Ghana police force be sold? Would they allow themselves to be sold for $20 million?
Our country is more than $20 million. People have died to save this country for us. And we are enjoying the mood at which we find ourselves. You are bringing in people that whatever they come to do here, we can't do them anything. If they come to rape our wives, our sisters, our mothers, we have nothing to say.
The government has defended the deal, saying the country's sovereignty has not been sold. But as opposition MPs seek to put pressure on the president, a few private citizens have filed a motion at the country's Supreme Court seeking a ruling to reverse the deal.
DW's Isaac Kaleje reporting from Ghana's capital, Accra.
And we did ask on our Facebook page, what is your take on this? Don Romeo Chris says the government should follow the voice of the people. What's the importance of the deal to the people of Ghana? He says African governments have to learn how to empower its citizens and engage in a level of self-governance.
And we have another response here from Noel Ibune, who writes, saying there is nothing to benefit when another country strong handling you to accept a military base in your country, promising $20 million a year with complete access to airspace, radio network, telecommunication, and complete immunity. That's not a good deal.
That's a point to ponder, for sure, as we move on to our top story world. And this time, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was given a lavish welcome by Chinese President Xi Jinping during a secretive trip to Beijing in what is seen as a first step towards denuclearization.
Now, the two sides are also seeking to repair frayed relations before Pyongyang's landmark summit with Seoul and Washington. Ina Kemuel has more.
The two leaders had not met since Kim took over after the death of his father, Kim Jong-il, in December 2011. Relations have been strained as China has backed a series of tough UN sanctions against Pyongyang over its nuclear and missile tests. Analysts believe the meeting sends a clear signal regarding the two countries. Here is Michael Kovrig, a senior advisor for Northeast Asia at International Crisis Group.
This is Kim's first meeting that we are aware of internationally, the first time he meets a foreign leader. So there's huge significance that it's China. That's, I think, both China signaling that it is the regional power to be reckoned with, and any kind of management or ultimately resolution of the Korean Peninsula tensions has that road running through Beijing.
But what does the meeting mean for the North Korean leader? Kovrig explains.
Kim now has pivoted from an amazingly rapid nuclear buildup to charm and diplomacy. For Kim, this meeting is a means to demonstrate that relations with China, despite all the past tensions, are still not so bad, and that China's got his back. Kim has now demonstrated that he can actually have such discussions with other statesmen. That increases the probability that we'll have a meeting with Moon Jae-in and then with Donald Trump potentially.
US President Donald Trump has welcomed the meeting and said there was now a good chance Kim would scrap his nuclear weapons, but warned that sanctions must stay in force in the meantime.
Ineke Mules with that report.
Let's take you back to Africa. Ethiopia's ruling coalition has elected a new leader, Abiy Ahmed, who is expected to be sworn in as prime minister within days.
Ahmed was voted chairperson of the ruling Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, EPRDF, late on Tuesday. The appointment comes 6 weeks after former Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn resigned amid widespread anti-government demonstrations.
Now, since violence broke in August 2016, almost 700 people have been killed. Many hope this appointment will help calm things down. But will he bring new ideas to Ethiopia's conservative political leadership? A question I put to Ludger Shadomsky, head of DW's Amharic service.
Well, it's pretty much the question of the day, isn't it? Well, what I can tell you, he's very young, at 41. He's very eloquent. That's a change from your sort of trademark Ethiopian politician. So that's a good start. And he has a huge appeal with the youngsters, the young population. As you know, Ethiopia is a very young country, especially some of the more nasty scenes we've been witnessing over the past few weeks when Oromo youngsters went on the rampage. I think he is the one to rein them in and to talk sense to them. But chiefly, obviously, he is from the Oromo ethnic group, which in the Ethiopian ethnic setup is quite a new thing. It's a dramatic change. And for the first time, the Oromos, as the largest ethnic group in Ethiopia, are actually taking the trophy. Whether now he will make a major impact very much remains to be seen.
The Oromo and Amhara regions have been engulfed by violent protests over political and ethnic marginalization. Now, Ahmed will be the first head of state from the Oromo ethnic group, as you said there, since the EPDRF, that's the ruling party, came to power in 91. Will this appointment put an end to this unrest that we've seen in the Oromia and Amhara regions?
I think it will in the short run, definitely. But we've also been speaking to Oromo youngsters, the so-called Keros. That's youth in the Oromo language for you. And they've been telling us, okay, we give him the benefit of the doubt, but simply because he's an Oromo now at the helm of the country does not mean we have achieved freedom. There's still no jobs. There's no political participation per se. So he better be quick to deliver. And they told us very bluntly, if he doesn't come up with solutions, and some of those youngsters are thinking about is regime change. They want a more general change in the leadership of the country, in the EPRDF. So for the time being, I think things will calm down. The question remains whether he will do away with a state of emergency at some point. But people are very restless over jobs, the youngsters. So if he is seen as a non-delivery kind of politician yet again, then there's bound to be a lot of action on the ground.
Ludger Shadomsky from DW Amharic Service.
And of course, a quick response here from Sisa Gima, who says, let us accept this change and try to help him for a big change through political dialogue and process.
And Michael Tesfaye says there will be no change in Ethiopia. A quick one from Haile Alemu, who says, surrounding people matters. If he tries to exercise his power freely, he might be assassinated. Well,
yeah, we hope that will not happen for sure.
I hope he doesn't get that far. Keep it Africa Link.
Welcome back to the program. My name is Ipora Nyambura.
And I am Abubakar Jalo. Africa Link is also live on Facebook, DW Africa. Check it out.
Still to come, Rwandan refugees in Uganda still live in fear, even days after the heads of state meeting downplaying allegations of tensions.
Fears are there. Kayihura is still at large, and the agents of Kagame, they are at large. People have been given genocide crimes. All these people were extradited. They are facing justice on cooked stories or framed evidences.
And we will also get to hear how farmers in Zimbabwe are saving seeds in food banks to fight hunger.
For sure, Abu, we are looking forward to that. But first, we listen to this one from Somalia. We all know the old cliche, education is life. That's because it not only opens doors, but also prepares us to tackle life challenges.
But not every child gets that right, especially in countries which have been plunged in civil war. In Somalia, over two decades of conflict meant that access to basic education was among the world's lowest.
Now, nearly 3 million children are not in school, with the most affected in southern and central Somalia. But all hope is not gone, since an organization called NGO Educate a Child has pledged to provide education to over 100,000 children. I talked to the director, Dr. Mary Joy Pigozzi, who has decades of experience in the field. Take a listen.
We do believe that only about 42% of those who have the primary school age are actually enrolled. So that's a very low number. And that actually coincides with a very low human development index for the country as a whole. So what Educate a Child is doing with several partners is, while important, probably not touching the majority of the children who are out of school. It focuses quite a bit on essentially reconstruction, building schools, trying to address the teacher shortage with teacher training, and also helping to build community support for education.
Yeah, that's quite a good step that you will work with schools in the community. But how closely are you working with the government to fulfill your mission?
So basically what our partners do is they work in particularly here with Mercy Corps. They are working through the Ministry of Education, so part of their program is to engage with the Ministry of Education, to link the Ministry of Education with mobilized communities, and to really work with reinforcing the capacity of the Ministry of Education through training and technical support, those kinds of activities, because in addition to actually providing the education to the out-of-school children, obviously what all of us want is for the ministry to be more and more capable to take on these responsibilities on its own.
We all know, apart from the current political crisis, Somalia faces more challenges like drought, poverty, child soldiers, which is also a problem to kids going to school. How prepared are you to deal with such situations?
Those certainly are critical areas that have to be addressed. One, as an educator, one cannot perhaps bring on rain, but one can help to train and help people understand resilience, to understand how to better use water, those kinds of things. In the long run, education does help address the poverty problem. For child soldiers, school is certainly an alternative. It is a way to bring young children or young people back into society in a more constructive way. I think one of the other areas that the Mercy Corps project will be dealing with is actually gender disparities in the education system. And that is yet another one of the challenges that needs to be faced if we're going to get to education for all Somali children.
Mary Pigozzi, Director of Educate a Child.
And we'd like to say thanks to all of you who are listening to us live on Facebook. I can see Mohammed Ahmed listening there. Padimo. Also, we have Sylvia Alberto. Thanks for joining Africa Link on DW Africa.
On the spot.
Now, days after Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni met his Rwandan counterpart Paul Kagame to iron out the animosity between the two countries, Rwandan refugees living in Uganda are still worried. Tensions between the two nations have risen over claims of spying, forced repatriation and torture.
Uganda accused Rwanda of sending people to hunt down and repatriate its own citizens, some of them registered refugees. Meanwhile, some Rwandans accuse Ugandan security agents of torturing them under suspicion of being spies. As our DW correspondent Alex Gita found out, many Rwandan refugees are still living in fear that they will continue to be hunted.
The two heads of state may have downplayed reports of tension and said all was well, but many Rwandan refugees in Uganda believe much is yet to be done. I talked to one of them who prefers to remain anonymous due to security reasons.
We did not see any kind of talking about it even, and from the body language of these two presidents, we think they are just cosmetizing about the whole issue.
Uganda has also made some changes to its police force, where Inspector General Kale Kayihura was removed following allegations of harassing the refugees. The reshuffle in the police came after claims of spying, kidnapping, and illegally repatriating Rwandan refugees on behalf of the Kigali administration. The refugees petitioned the Uganda government and later dragged Kayihura to the International Criminal Court. Their case is yet to be heard, but they believe this presents one of the best chances for justice, as one of them narrates.
We are still asking President Museveni to take Kayihura to court. Obviously, we petitioned to ICC, and we are expecting ICC to do something. So basically, fears are there. Kayihura is still at large, and the agents of Kagame, they are at large.
Many here believe the meeting was a waste of time because state-sponsored kidnappings are still going on. They say some of their colleagues are facing false charges back in Rwanda.
People have been given genocide crimes. All these people were extradited. They are facing justice on cooked stories or framed evidences.
As Museveni and Kagame met on Sunday in Kampala, another Rwandan was being arrested by the Uganda army on suspicion that he was a spy. Yakaremie Cloud, who rides a motorcycle taxi, is being held incommunicado, as human rights lawyer Aaron Kizar says.
We are concerned that it comes against the backdrop of the two presidents of Rwanda and Uganda having reconciled and informed the security forces to cooperate. The continued detention of Rwandans living in Uganda is unfortunate, and the concerned overzealous officers should stop it immediately, because ultimately they may also face the wrath of the law.
As much as the leaders deny the existence of tensions between the two countries, security and political analyst Dismas Nkunda thinks otherwise.
It's not the first time. It has been going on for some time. The purging of the Ugandan police forces, the indifference in terms of Museveni refusing to go to the AU summit, which was very dear for him in Kigali, the refusal of Kagame to come for the East African Community Summit meeting in Uganda, all show that there's something that is tangibly not right between the two countries.
That report was compiled by Alex Chita in Kampala.
Living Planet Africa.
One of major crops in Zimbabwe is maize or corn, but monocultures can be especially vulnerable, especially under extreme weather conditions. That is something that lots of African farmers are experiencing. Some communities in Zimbabwe are now starting to switch to local varieties.
Now, they are often hardier, can make do with less rain, and can withstand pests. An agricultural research institute wants to set up a seed bank for these resilient plants and encourage farmers to grow a variety of crops. TW's Tawanda Mupatsi has more.
Northern Zimbabwe's rivers have dried up due to a severe drought in the region. Desperate villagers have dug holes along the dried-out river to collect water to keep their gardens moist. Over 80% of the nation's farmers grow maize. Hard hit by the dry spell in this region, much of the crop has already begun to wilt. Hilton Mbozi is an agronomist with Communitec, an NGO that seeks to improve the livelihoods of rural communities in the country. He is convinced that maize cultures can't provide food and seed security.
With this climate change now, maize always fail.
farmers, maybe 5 years, they plant maize or they grow maize, maybe they just get a decent yield once out of every 5 years. So maize is very susceptible to droughts, to stresses caused by climate change.
Communitech has helped establish the Chibika Community Seed Bank to promote the more drought and stress-tolerant varieties of small grains, like sorghum or chickpeas. Dorothy Chiwotanziawa has taken delivery of small grain, which she has paid in seed in the past. This in turn will boost the bank's seed stock. The seeds are stored under cool and dry conditions, and they can last for up to 2 years in the facility.
The good thing about a seed bank is that it's monitored by different agricultural specialists. In addition, the seed bank is well secured. It's different from keeping your seed within the confines of your household. In a household setup, your seed might be destroyed by fire or even theft.
So far, there are only a few places like Harare's biggest open market where small grain farmers can sell their products. But gradually, awareness and attitudes are changing.
Compared with previous years, things have changed. Demand is now very high among customers.
As a result, the price of a 20-kilogram unit of small grains is 40% higher than that for maize. That has prompted Communitech to also create a local company where farmers can now supply their produce and in turn get paid. The seed bank in northern Zimbabwe's Mudzi district is already working with over 40 villages.
Now we need to move a gap. Farmers, why not actually also build the capacity of the farmers so that they produce seed on their own? Because seed, especially the hybrid seed, is very expensive.
For farmers in Zimbabwe's drought-stricken rural areas, small grain seed banks are a welcome opportunity to move away from the high risks of maize farming. They provide food security and cut costs for the farmers and their families.
DW's Tawanda Mupatsi.
Now, let's take you back to our main story of the day, which is the protest in Ghana against the deal with the United States to allow the U.S. to set up a military base in Ghana. Now, a response here from Njikum Yusuf. He says, a peaceful country has been chosen for arms testing in Africa, another Afghanistan, Middle East, and sorrow is looming in Africa.
Well, that's his opinion. And Lisi Musa says the deal will exempt the U.S. from paying tax to Ghana and the U.S. troops will not be bound by the laws of Ghana. He says, we are not happy with this deal.
Abu Chempol Daniel says, I'm worried about this deal. Why can't they, the U.S., leave us Africans alone? Must we continue to be a slave in our own land? Never. This is unacceptable.
Well, Abu, but someone seems actually to answer that. That is Amo Charles, who says, Ghanaians should exercise patience. The government knows what it's doing and will protect Ghana all the time. He says, he goes on to say, this is not the first time there's an agreement between Ghana and the U.S. I'm sure the two parties will benefit greatly from this deal. And he says, time will definitely tell, so Ghanaians should exercise patience.
And there's the accusation that this is taking away Ghanaian sovereignty, giving it to the U.S.
Yeah, and as this person is saying, the president is in charge, they should just wait a little bit longer and see what happens.
From my end, one final comment here from Esmeraldo Francisco. He asks, what has Djibouti benefited from having military bases of four greatest powers? Africans are becoming unwise to fall to hopes on hopeless white man's deal. That's a very strong comment there.
Yeah, but that is his opinion, of course.
It's definitely his opinion.
Yeah.
If you have a final comment there?
Yeah, of course, Abu. I have one here from Paul Washington, who says, Ghana's economy was fast becoming the best in sub-Saharan Africa. And he says, I knew something was fishy. Never trust the U.S.
Anyways, I said that was my last one. I will give you my final last one here from Emmanuel Fondi. I find that interesting. He says, Ghana is in peace. It's a peace and prospering country. They don't need a military base. Let them push the government back. That's a good one.
Yeah, for sure, Abu. I think this will continue to generate lots of discussions on our Facebook page.
Definitely. That's all we have time for. It's been a pleasure. My name is Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Zipora Nyambura. Bye for now.